On This Week at Enterprise Tech, we have the amazing Mr. Brian Chee joining me on the show today. Now, medical devices are on the short list for vulnerabilities in the cyber threat realm. Plus, the FDA is stepping in, and they're going to try to force an overhaul. If you're in the modern workforce, odds are you have a large amount of intellectual property and data inside a spreadsheet. And today, we have John Briscoe. He's CEO and co-founder of Coherent, and he's going to take us through just how you can unlock all of that using a SaaS service where you can even build scalable apps all over it. You definitely shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 541, recorded April 28th, 2023. A spreadsheet for tracking your spreadsheets. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Melissa. More than 10,000 clients worldwide in retail, education, healthcare, insurance, finance, and government rely on Melissa for full spectrum data quality and ID verification software. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Get started today with 1,000 records clean for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Lookout. Whether on a device or in the cloud, your business data is always on the move. Minimize risk, increase visibility, and ensure compliance with Lookout's unified platform. Visit lookout.com today. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through the big world of the enterprise. And what a big and busy world it is, but I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in a professional and an expert. And while Mr. Curtis Franklin's gallivanting around the Golden City, we're going to get down to business with our very own network and security expert, Mr. Brian Chee. How are you, my friend? What's been keeping you busy?
I'm actually having a lot of fun doing digital signage. Seems the media players embedded in a lot of TVs are more than a little inadequate. They're very, very picky. They won't play the video quite right. And even if they do play it, it'll only play through once. And I've got to manually restart, which, you know, for something that's hanging, you know, 20 feet up in the air, that's probably not going to work very well. So I'm playing around a lot with BrightSign, and I'm actually really looking forward to meeting with the BrightSign folks this coming June at the Orlando Convention Center for the Infocom show. So that's going to be fun. And I have been getting fiber in my diet, single mode variety, hooking up the Central Florida Fairgrounds. Lots of fun.
And when's the first time you're going to debut the BrightSign setup? Have you already used it? Or
I've been using BrightSign for a while for lots of different things, but the first time it's going to show up at the fairgrounds is actually more dependent upon the head of sales and the person that does our graphic design. They've got to get me content, and then we need to set up. I'm going to set up a private VLAN just for digital signage so that it's less likely someone's going to muck around with digital signage. I have seen, shall we say, some embarrassing hacks at some hotels in the Vegas area for people that didn't pay attention to security on their digital signage.
I bet. I see that on a daily basis, so I totally get that.
Yeah.
Well, welcome back, Chee. It's great to have you here. Well, we should definitely get started because we have lots to talk about today. Medical devices are on the short list for people and organizations as being very vulnerable to cyber threats. In fact, most hospitals actually air gap most of them. While the FDA is stepping in and trying to force an overhaul here, we're going to get into what they're trying to actually do. If you're in the modern business world, odds are you have a large amount of intellectual property, including data analytics, in a spreadsheet. That's right. You're using it right now. Well, today we have John Briscoe. He's CEO and co-founder of Coherent, and he's going to take us through how you're going to unlock all of that using their SaaS service where you can even build scalable apps with it. So stick around. Lots of interesting stuff to talk about. But first, like we always do, we have lots to talk about here in the Enterprise Week. So let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Rob Joyce, the NSA's cybersecurity director, is sounding the alarm on the security threats posed by generative AI. According to this Wall Street Journal and Wired articles, he's asking us to buckle up and be prepared for the impact of this technology, which is being increasingly sophisticated. ChatGPT, for example, can generate convincing text that can be used to create deep fakes, fake news articles, and other materials that can spread misinformation or even damage a person's reputation. Now, Joyce is concerned that malicious actors could use generative AI to steal sensitive data, disrupt critical infrastructure, or launch other cyber attacks. You think you're getting phishing emails today? Well, imagine ones that can actually pass your smell test going forward. Joyce is calling out on the security community to take these threats seriously and develop new ways to protect against them. The truth is, with any new technology, there's always the good and the bad. Now, there's amazing potential for generative AI as well. And there's no question that it will also aid in big data analysis and automation going forward. In the meantime, it's up to you to stay safe online. So let's put on our thinking caps and remember to be skeptical of everything we read. Don't click on the links from unknown senders. Be careful about the information we share. Keep our software up to date and use strong password managers. Today and together, we can definitely outsmart the threats posed by AI and keep ourselves secure.
Well, when I did a lot of research at the University of Hawaii, I was considered part of the tree hugger contingent. And this is definitely right in the wheelhouse of the University of Hawaii because of the work we did on king tides and how sea levels have been rising. Well, that's not the only part of the question we need to ask ourselves. And this particular Ars Technical article is headlined as "Sea Levels Rise, the East Coast is Also Sinking." Anyway, climate scientists already know that the East Coast of the United States could see around a foot of sea level rise by 2050, which will be catastrophic on its own. But they are just beginning to thoroughly measure a hidden vulnerability that will make matters far worse. The coastline is also sinking. It's a phenomenon known as subsidence, and it's poised to make the rising ocean all more dangerous, both for people and coastal ecosystems. New research published in the Journal of Nature Communications finds that the Atlantic coast, home to more than a third of the U.S. population, is dropping by several millimeters per year. In Charleston, South Carolina, and Chesapeake Bay, it's up to 5 millimeters, about a fifth of an inch. In some areas of Delaware, it's as much as twice as that. Well, the story goes on to say, in addition to that, as much as 12 feet has been lost in the San Jose area and is being attributed to overuse of groundwater. In island areas like Puerto Rico and Hawaii, this overuse of available groundwater is also causing water shortages. The Enterprise spin on this is that organizations need to pay attention to ecological changes that could lead to flooding in coastal areas, sinkholes, and seawater back flooding up river estuaries. So, warning to urban planners and city governments, you may want to think very carefully about approving that bottled water plant or other types of manufacturing that have large freshwater needs. For our enterprise planners, perhaps basement data centers in coastal areas might have to be rethought.
There are a number of sovereign clouds around the world. That means across different geolocations, generative AI technology is not possible. In this Reuters article, in a move that could shake up the artificial intelligence market, Russia's largest bank, Sberbank, has released its own chatbot called GigaChat. Now, the chatbot is designed to rival ChatGPT, popular chatbot developed by Microsoft-backed OpenAI. Now, GigaChat is still in an invite-only testing mode, but it will release broadly by the end of the year. Now, the chatbot is available in Russian and English, and it's going to be used to perform a variety of tasks, such as booking appointments, making reservations, and providing customer support. Sberbank says that what it sets apart for GigaChat is that the fact that it has the ability to communicate more intelligently in Russian directly. Now, the bank has invested heavily in artificial intelligence in recent years, and it's hoping that GigaChat will help it to reduce its reliance on foreign technology. Now, the release of GigaChat comes at a time when Russia is facing an increasing set of sanctions from the West. The sanctions have made it difficult for Russian companies to actually import technologies. And they've made it also difficult for Russian consumers to access foreign products and services. GigaChat can actually help to mitigate some of those effects of the sanctions. The chatbot can provide Russian consumers with access to services that they would otherwise have to do without. It could also help Russian companies to reduce the reliance on, of course, foreign technologies. Now, China seems to be taking a similar approach, and a number of companies are working on homegrown alternatives to ChatGPT, with examples including ErnieBot, developed by Baidu, and Moss, developed by NLP Lab at Fudan University. What this does prove is the impact of large language models and generative AI across the globe and different markets. What's for dinner?
All right. So we have been on a soapbox for good knows how long. And we've said, please, at the very least, use password vaults. And I will say Bitwarden is one of the sponsors of Twit TV. But this one is actually about Google. And it is more about the syncing between services than the actual password vault functions. So this particular CNET article is about their cloud authentication system and how it caches. So the Google Authenticator app, which was updated earlier this week to allow for cloud-based two-factor authentication via your Google account, isn't end-to-end encrypted yet, according to software company MISC. Quote, we analyze the network traffic when the app syncs the secrets, and it turns out the traffic is not end-to-end encrypted, said MISC via Twitter, as reported by Gizmodo earlier Wednesday. As shown in the screenshots, this is talking about the article, this means that Google can see the secrets, likely even while they're stored on their servers, and currently there is no option to add a passphrase to protect the secrets. Well, the article does go on to state that Google's authenticator at the writing of the article does not support end-to-end encryption when you turn on the features that would allow you to recover if your phone is lost or stolen. So that's the syncing portion. Google says it is coming, but for now, Google's cloud authentication system is flawed. And I do stress the cloud authentication system is flawed and should be used carefully until this 2FA syncing feature is fixed. And I will say, everybody, please, 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 if you are still using passwords, and you know most of us are, for goodness sakes, use a password vault that does a good job of encrypting and you can generate really big random passwords. Please, pretty please.
Amen to that. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the News Bites. But before we get to the News Bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Melissa. Digital onboarding and ID verification is a necessary tool to reduce fraud, improve customer engagement, and ensure you have peace of mind. Melissa verifies the authenticity of an ID documents and allows customers to securely submit their identity information anytime, from anywhere, and on their preferred device from an easy-to-use mobile app. There are four things to consider when looking for a digital onboarding and ID verification service. ID checks. Today, machine-readable zone, or MRZs, and optical character recognition technologies can instantly identify document types such as passports, driver's licenses, and other country IDs. In this step, your solution should also extract client data and populate data into your relevant systems like CRM platforms with no manual entry. You also want biometric checks to make sure your prospective customer is who they say they are. Biometric checks can use facial recognition and comparison algorithms to recognize and match between a selfie and an ID image. This check should distinguish changes like facial hair, makeup, hairstyle, and even more. You also want liveness checks. That's right. Along with biometric checks, liveness check should also be present. This check determines if the person behind the device they're using to onboard is live instead of, you know, a static image, distinguishes eye movement and other small changes to ensure the user's authenticity. Compliance reporting is also very important. Make sure that your digital onboarding partner keeps full audit trails and customer due diligence reports. Now, these reports are critical for your business and should be organization controlled with the ability to evaluate anytime you want. Along with compliance reporting, you should be able to review and approve customer submissions with ease. Get all of this and more with Melissa's digital onboarding and verification services. Since 1985, Melissa has specialized in global intelligence solutions and continually undergoes independent security audits to reinforce its commitment to data security, privacy, and compliance requirements. They are SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant, so you know your data is in the best hands. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time for the bites. Now, we have a couple to talk about today. Now, medical devices are a great way to save lives, but not so great for actually protecting your data. In fact, we talked about this. Some hospitals actually have those devices in air gap environments. Now, according to this Dark Reading article, that's why the FDA has issued a new set of rules to make sure these devices don't become easy targets for hackers and cyber criminals. Now, from now on, medical device makers must show the FDA how they plan to keep their devices updated and secure from digital threats. They also must provide a list of all software components using a software bill of materials that go into their devices so they can any vulnerabilities can be quickly spotted and fixed right away. Now, these new rules are part of the law that Congress actually passed in 2023, which sets some basic cybersecurity standards for medical devices. Now, the FDA is also looking into how to actually make sure the medical devices are serviced securely and safely, and is asking for feedback on this topic. So you actually provide some of that. The FDA's actions are part of a larger effort to actually boost the security and resilience of health IT. But experts actually warn that there's still a lot of work to be done here and to prevent hackers from compromising those medical devices and putting your patients at risk. Now, the FDA's new guidance is an important step in the right direction, but it's just one piece of the puzzle. Now, I'm going to bring Cheever back in here because, you know, what are your you're a network guy. What are your recommendations here on how to protect medical devices from cyber threats?
Well, actually, I think this is a really, really good first step, mostly because Kurt has actually brought this up when we talk about this theme. And the problem is right now, or at least until these rules take effect, a change even in, say, something like modifying, say, a CT machine, you actually have to get it recertified, even though you're just patching bugs. Well, this might be blowing it a little bit out of proportion, but there has been horror stories about medical instrument people saying they can't change X because it was approved with Y. It's frustrating. And this is just me, you know, talking out loud and thinking out loud that the FDA, I think, is trying to close those loopholes and make it easier to do things like major bug fixes, adding this and that, maybe changing libraries if a DLL or something has been found that's compromised. Make it easier and faster for medical instrument developers to make intelligent changes that we all know should be done, but their hands have been tied. And if you've ever really looked hard at the regulatory issues surrounding a medical instrument maker, you would throw up your hands in disgust and walk away because they are convoluted with a capital C. So I think this is a great move in the right direction. I think some of the things that are changing are in the about time category. And, you know, anyone with a good software background has been throwing up their hands because why hasn't this been done sooner? And it's because when you have a large governmental agency involved with making rules, they're going to try and, you know, kill an ant with a sledgehammer. And
It's true. It's really true. Now, I think it's definitely a good step in the right direction, because obviously you always tend to look, organizations especially, they go and look at the medical devices that they're purchasing, and they want things that are FDA approved. And so if this means that these devices and these, you know, these IoT devices, whatever they are not marked as FDA approved because they are not following the guidelines that FDA mm-hmm. provides, I think that's going to be a ding on people's bottom line. Like, the people are not going to buy them because of that. And I think, you know, that means that organizations are going to have to step up and start following these things. It's almost a forcing function for them to do so. But I think the problem is there's still a ton of devices in this world right now that are already out there. They're already mm-hmm. insecure and they're already having problems. We've talked about this before. You obviously make sure things are patched, make sure you're updating passwords regularly, make sure things are not have access to the internet if they don't need it. Be careful of, you know, making sure that your information on those devices are secure. You know, look for signs, obviously, of cybersecurity access. Obviously, this is assume breach scenarios where if people are trying to access the device unexpectedly, you should know that. Keep track of that. So there's lots of things that you can do to at least assist yourself and your organization on making sure that you keep these things secure. Cheaper, is anything else you recommend to people to make sure that they're managing what they already have in their inventory?
Air gaps are truly wonderful things. You know, it's not hard to set up, say, for instance, an isolated VLAN just for these things, and don't give it internet access. Don't make it so that the CT scan operator can check their email on the console. That's not a good combination. But I do want to bring up one other issue. As we start getting medical equipment that are, quote, not FDA approved because of these new rules, what's going to happen to them? The used medical equipment market, I think, is going to explode. And I keep wondering where they're going to go. So if we have nice strong rules in the US, are they going to go to second and third world nations? You know, I don't like those labels because they connotate the wrong things, but there are several have not organizations that would probably be real interested in buying used medical equipment, but I'm hoping they exercise some intelligence on how they use that equipment and also protect their patients' privacy. Just because we change our rules doesn't mean it's going to make it affordable for everybody else.
Right. Yeah. I wish there was a grandfathered rule where, you know, pre-existing devices, even if you buy them, are required to still provide software bill materials, are also required to provide, you know, when, how long they're going to be, how often and how long they're going to be, you know, serviced and brought up to date. I feel like this still needs to be a requirement. There's still a bunch of things missing there. And yeah, I do agree. Like, this is definitely going to force organizations, if they have the money, to upgrade and move these things out into the secondary market, which, you know, there'll definitely be a flood out there of people trying to make back that cost. But that also means that manufacturers are going to want to make back their costs, right? Like, this is going to cost them even more money to manage what they ship.
Yeah. And I guess this is, again, my personal opinion is, what happened, folks? This is actually doing things that make sense. If nothing else, that software bill of materials should have been something you had internal. You know, if wishes were fishes, you know, there's a lot of wishful thinking going on here. And I'm hoping and praying that the DevOps people, well, development folks for a lot of these medical instrument companies have paid attention. And that software bill of materials really should have been part of their original documentation, even if it's only internal. So, if you guys have been paying attention, maybe, just maybe, this would be a new set of rules that are easy to comply with, or should be easy to comply with, or I wish were easy to comply with. Choose your, you know, A, B, or C. There's a lot of things that can be done, should be done, but have they been done?
Right. All right, I think that will put that the one to bed here. But we want to talk about the next, because there's a vulnerability that's pretty interesting here that I want to get into. Now, there's a new vulnerability out there that's making hackers drool like hungry wolves. According to this Dark Reading article, it's the Service Location Protocol, SLP flaw, and it's a doozy. That's right. It allows attackers to turn a tiny DDoS attack into a massive one that can actually knock out an entire network. Now, how massive, you may ask? Well, about 2,200 times bigger than normal. That's right. It's not a typo. That's like taking a water gun and turning it into a fire hose or a slingshot into a rocket launcher. You get the idea. And we might be wondering what SLP is and why it matters. Well, SLP is a really old protocol that actually helps devices find each other on a network. And it's like essentially a dating app for machines, except instead of swiping right or left, they actually send messages to each other, actually saying things like, hi, I'm here. I can do this. And now it sounds harmless. But the fact is, it's not, because SLP is really old and outdated, and it's has a lot of security holes that hackers can exploit. And one of them is actually this nasty flaw that lets them access any file on the system with admin privileges, with the admin privilege context. The bad news here is the SLP is still used by a lot of enterprise products, which means they're actually vulnerable to this attack. And the good news is some of them have patches available to fix them. But the not so good news is that some of them don't. So if you're using any products that use SLP, you better check if they have updates and patches already. And if they don't, you better start praying hackers don't find you. The new vulnerability is just another example of why cybersecurity is pretty important in today's world. As technologies evolve, so do the risks that come with it. Now, the truth is there's actually some modern alternatives out there to this particular protocol. There's UPnPs, there's MNDNS, there's Zero Config, there's also WS Discovery. Now, a number of commercial products still offer this protocol only. Now, researchers have identified more than 2,000 global organizations and more than 54,000 SLP instances, including VMware ESXi Hypervisor, Konica Minolta Printers, Linux Routers, IBM Integrated Management Modules, and Supermicro IPMI. Now, I'm going to bring Cheebert back in because obviously this is a big deal. The fact that lots of services, lots of devices still are using SLP. What can organizations do to protect themselves here?
Well, here's one more, toss of gasoline onto the fire. SLP is part of the CUPS Linux print server. And so if you're running an older version of CUPS, and this is why this became a cascade effect, lots and lots of older routers, lots and lots of older webcams and so forth are all based on old versions of Linux. This is that same rant that I've been going on. All of us have been going on over and over again. You're developing a product. Why haven't you used the latest version of Linux? Well, okay, you have to freeze your config, get it ready, but one would hope there was some sort of upgrade path or upgrade plan so they can get onto something a little more modern. Well, that wonderful feature that your marketing people said would be great, having a printer hung off the USB port on a router, is probably implemented with CUPS and is probably implemented with SLAP, well, SLP. All of us tend to call it SLAP. SLAP has been around for a very, very long time, and it is a great thing. When you go and say, oh, what are the printers near me and things like that, or I want to go and find all the webcams. If we have a webcam, you plug it in and it grabs an address from the DHCP server. How do you find it afterwards? Well, a lot of people don't know how to go into the DHCP server and look up the MAC addresses. That's small skill. So what these manufacturers have done is they say, let's go and take advantage of a well-established, well-debugged, quote-unquote, protocol called Service Location Protocol, so that we can go and have an app, say, on a phone, and discover all the webcams and do their thing. I'm not going to name names, but a heck of a lot of web security cameras use SLAP. And that's why those numbers are so ginormous. And here's the other thing that kind of makes me a little angry is Slap does support single key encryption, so that at least you can't go and sniff for that. But even in my experience, just going around doing different things, I have almost never seen an encrypted Slap connection. So makes you kind of wonder who got lazy, because the protocol allows it, but the developers didn't. So anyway, Slap is something, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but in this case, I think just badly implemented.
It's true for a lot of protocols out there. I love the chatter that's going on in the chat room right now, especially the comment that says "Slap serious lazy programmers." I love that. Keith 512. It's true. I think that just like Brian said, if device manufacturers would get on their updates here, they would actually be able to update this and start using some more secure protocols, obviously. Now, obviously, this goes back to making sure that you secure your devices behind a VLAN or whatnot, not having access, not having allow people to actually have access to this chatter that's going across the network. But what do you think? What else? Something else said?
I actually want to defend my beaten down developer brethren. I've seen some bad choices implemented, and it wasn't driven by the developers. It was you guys and girls, you're late. Get it done under budget. We're not making enough money. You need to get this done. We need to get the product out now. And I've heard this coming from marketing people and salespeople over and over and over again. And I've seen bad products driven by people that don't understand the decisions. And I will draw an analogy. It's kind of like someone saying, I'm going to tell fighter pilots that they need to go and do this, that, or the other thing, and it's being done by someone that was a supply sergeant.
Great analogy. Well, thank you, Chibert. Well, next up, we have our guest. But before we get to the guest, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Lookout. Business has changed forever. Boundaries to where we work or even how we work have literally disappeared. Whether on a device, in the cloud, across networks, or at the local coffee shop, your data is always on the move. While that is great for your workforce, it's a challenge for any IT pro or IT security personnel. Lookout helps you control your data and free your workforce. That means with Lookout, you'll gain complete visibility into all your data so you can minimize risk from external and internal threats, plus ensure compliance by seamlessly securing your hybrid work. Organization doesn't have to sacrifice productivity or security. And Lookout makes IT security a lot simpler. Working with multi-point solutions and legacy tools in today's environment is just too complex. With its single unified platform, Lookout reduces IT complexity, giving you more time to focus on whatever else comes your way. Good data protection isn't a cage. It's a springboard letting you and your organization bound toward a future of your making. Visit lookout.com today to learn how to safeguard data, secure hybrid work, and reduce IT complexity. That's lookout.com. And we thank Lookout for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Rye. And today we have John Briscoe. He's CEO and co-founder of Coherent. Welcome to the show, John.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, our audience is a wide range of professionals, whether they're starting out or they're CISOs, CTOs, CEOs, and some of them love to hear people's origin stories. So can you take us through an abridged journey through tech and what brought you to Coherent?
You certainly can, Lou. So first and foremost, is a Scottish accent. And that accent never goes away, even though I've been away from Scotland for nearly 25 years. My career has basically been mostly in technology, corporate technology to begin with, traveled the world, UK, then Asia, Australia, back to Asia. And then about 5 years ago, created this little business called Coherent, which over the last 5 years had started in Hong Kong, where I was living, is now kind of growing in 11 different offices globally and servicing over 150 organizations. So it's been a journey of global pandemic kind of challenges and global sort of culture, sort of diversity, but it's been something which has been very fulfilling to date.
That's fantastic. I love hearing these journeys like that. Especially, I'm actually very excited about today because this is definitely in my wheelhouse. I want to start first with no code because it's a huge trend in the market where people are just building solutions and they're able to build solutions because they're not specialized developers, IT people, and they need some tools to do that. And that's really what no code is really helping them do. Now, you might be aware I work for the Microsoft Office product group and I work on the Excel engineering team, and my team builds things like Office scripts to actually help people realize their potential on their data, actually help them unlock their spreadsheets and their data for more analytics. But Coherent is really having another spin here, where actually you're generating apps out of this data and logic. I want to hear more about this. What's going on? How's Coherent helping there?
Yeah, so I think essentially, maybe to take it one step further, we're actually codifying spreadsheets which are existing within companies. So the problem that I saw when I was working in corporate was essentially, regardless of how much money was getting spent on new systems, new platforms, process changes, spreadsheets existed everywhere, as you probably know, right? So the gap seemed to be that the business teams or business personnel would be constantly using spreadsheets to try and interpret how they wanted products or business rules to be functioning. But obviously IT teams essentially couldn't ingest that in a way which could then connect through to systems. So the idea being, imagine you could essentially codify spreadsheet logic, calculations, formulae, validations, run it into an API capability, which can then be essentially connected anywhere to any system. You then unlock 750 million Excel users, and at the same time, probably making a lot of programmers across the world much happier as well. So that was essentially the genesis of understanding that this problem permeated across nearly every sort of company worldwide. Could we create a bridge? And I think we've been starting to be able to do that.
I agree. Now let's talk tech for a moment, because Excel obviously isn't a database, but although people like to use it sometimes that way, and they can come close to a database with a lot of the extended features out there, but what are you guys doing with data that's, you're essentially semantically generating code and the app off the data and formulas in one package?
Yeah, it's a good description. So essentially recompiling into C++, the logic. And then from there, it's probably starting to run 100 to 1,000 times faster than Excel. And then I think some of the other sort of capabilities we're starting to add in, which are sometimes some of the most common misconceptions that may exist around Excel, is how do you build much more persistency plus also essentially security and version control around the original native Excel so that it can become a codified asset which can be utilized in your environment, right? So that in itself is probably the kind of the main sort of technical features of how we compile the solution for obviously IT teams. And then it comes with all the publishable API documentation and capabilities so that you can run whatever sort of formats and code snippets that you want to be implementing into different platforms that you have. And that, again, gives a lot of flexibility to different programming teams in order to take that capability, which has been produced in spreadsheets, and then unleash it elsewhere.
Amazing. So what if users have things like linked worksheets, external data sources that they're pulling in, they have macros attached to their sheets? Say some organizations have really complex worksheets and workbooks. How is this handled? Are you able to handle all of that?
So we've dealt with spreadsheets which are gigs in size, basically millions of formulas, millions of logic in them. Some of these spreadsheets take 12 to 15 hours to run. Some of them take 4 hours to open, yet they're critical to actually how the operation of that business runs on a day-to-day business, right? So the reality is financial services, I came from a financial services background. The reality is that spreadsheets are obviously very important to the day-to-day kind of running of how the business operates. So we realized from the very start, if we are going to say what we're going to do on the tin, we had to make sure that we're going to be able to compile all different types of models, all different types of logic and validations which exist. Deal with, you mentioned it, chaining of spreadsheets happens all over, right, as well as also dealing with data source ingestion, which comes into platforms as well. It's amazingly creative how business and IT teams are with spreadsheets, as you would know. I'm sure some of your listeners know as well about the amount of data that is getting ingested into kind of spreadsheets in order to compile analysis. We handle that as well. But again, obviously putting much more of that performance around how they can do that at greater scale.
Now, I've worked with SDKs before, and obviously, we've done a bunch of semantic code generation before, and it can be a challenge because obviously the market's moving really fast. Obviously, languages and things are up and down. How many languages do you actually support in the SDK?
So we do have a few different, like we call them code snippets. So I think there's about 4 or 5 that we're supporting. Like clearly, I think the ones that we constantly get asked on more enterprise C++, Python, etc., are probably the kind of predominant ones that we support. But there are a couple of other kind of key areas which we do offer. But in general, I would certainly say they're the ones that we offer the most on.
So to bring the barrier a little bit downstream, obviously, are they supported in a packaged way? Like obviously programming languages like C++ or C# or Java, they're compiled languages and they take some time to set up sometimes. For the novice, how is that handled?
Yeah, so essentially it's essentially a code snippet package which they can then essentially take and then insert and load with the relevant documentation around that. So that's what's made, we think, both business and IT teams essentially like our platform, because we're trying to make life as easy for those different teams in order to kind of essentially automate as much of that kind of compilation as possible.
Well, I do want to bring my co-host in a second, but I have one other question about the fact that the data, obviously you're taking data from Excel, you're wrapping and you're creating an app. Where's the data going? Where is it? Is it obviously some organizations might say, well, obviously now I have data in two places, or will it get out of sync, or is it stored in a compliant way? Mm-hmm. What's happening there? Maybe you can provide some insights for that.
Yeah, so look, we are obviously dealing with some of the largest financial services organizations in the world. So data movement, data kind of management, as well as obviously data security is very important. I think often, clearly, the kind of questions we get asked are around, where's the data going to be hosted? What different types of deployment options do you have? As well as obviously ensuring the accuracy of obviously the data as well. So we support basically cloud hosting via, unsurprisingly, Azure, AWS, and others. We have a hybrid deployment opportunity, or we have on-prem. And the on-prem is pretty cool. It's a kind of WASM WebAssembly insert, which is probably much more modern than traditional on-prem. And it means that upgrading the platform becomes a lot easier as well for our clients. And I think particularly in banking, that's very, very sort of attractive to the banks. And then included in the platform is a fairly sophisticated testing and simulation capability, so that essentially the logic which has been generated in the spreadsheet, almost like source of truth, essentially you can test and run to make sure that the outputs are exactly what the model is essentially saying. And to be honest, a lot of the time we're finding data inconsistencies in the model itself via the testing center, where errors within the spreadsheet weren't known, and our simulation center is effectively identified non-linear or essentially non-linear sort of practices in terms of the model, and then our clients can then update that model accordingly. So that deals with a lot of audit and compliance challenges, which a lot of these institutions face.
Interesting. Well, I do want to bring Brian back in. Jibber, you have some questions?
Actually, I want to describe a project that I was involved with that centered around a spreadsheet. And I was wondering, how would we do it today with something like your product? So this is, preface, this is almost a 20-year-old project. The spreadsheet actually linked through CICS onto an IBM mainframe because the student information had to sit there. And, you know, we were dealing with millions of student records.
Yep.
But what we did was the cashier's office had a huge challenge, and that was validating against the student database different rates, because different types of students, they had different rates per credit, whether you're a grad student, whether you're a med student, law student, so forth. So there's a lot, there's a really, really huge set of rules associated with per credit charges. And then we had to go and also balance all the cash drawers for the in-person registration and compare that also to what we're doing with the online credit card transactions.
Yeah.
Our biggest problem in that was those rules were god awful. Mm-hmm. And I imagined 20 years ago that, gee, an artificial intelligence would be absolutely perfect. But is it? Is the ChatGPT, large language models, AI, whatevers, getting sophisticated enough so we can start replacing all those lookups that we used to have to do to go and check, did we charge the correct rates? Are we charging the right students and so forth?
Yes, it's a really interesting question. So the use case you're talking about is a classic kind of combination of obviously calculation logic, business rules kind of logic, as well as reconciliation logic all in one. And believe it or not, that's very common across a lot of different institutions as they're trying to compile different data and insights from different source systems in order to try and understand patterns as well as decisions that they need to make. So I would say quite a large proportion of the use cases we're dealing with are dealing with those types of problems. And why spreadsheets get used is because they are the ubiquitous and probably most pervasive way of kind of compiling and the flexible kind of nature of piecing together those different kind of data points. I think the generative AI space then takes a step further, that we've created, I'm sure like many businesses, their generative AI sort of offering. And where we've started to kind of really focus on is, interestingly, you mentioned 20-year sort of challenge or problem. But just think about how many spreadsheets an institution has over the creation of since Excel, right? And they have no idea what that spreadsheet is. And it would take thousands of man days or even man years to go through every spreadsheet to try and figure out what it is. We've been working on how can you create a capability that basically automatically analyzes a spreadsheet and gives essentially an overview of what that spreadsheet is intended to do, where essentially the gaps in the spreadsheet may be, or in terms of where formulae can be updated to improve the model. Because I just think that's a massive sort of value attribution to enterprises moving forward, because ultimately you're never going to be able to kind of solve that problem just essentially by human sort of effort. It would just take too long. There has to be a better way. And I think if you really want to unlock that sort of web of spreadsheet IP, generative AI probably has to be one of the ways to do that moving forward.
Oh, wow. That was much more than I thought I'd get. That's awesome. Thank you. Anyway, I do want to point out to our viewers that keep in mind, PCs really and truly got started because of SuperCalc. Spreadsheets literally were day zero of this revolution. But we're now starting to look at, let's call it day zero or year zero of generative AI. And there's an awful lot of people that are playing Chicken Little. It's going to be a disaster. It's going to take over the world. Skynet's coming. you name it, I've heard it. But I'd like you to go and, you know, peer into your crystal ball. Time to soapbox a little bit. What do you see? Obviously, your corporation's based around generative AI. But how do you think? What kinds of things should we be doing? What kinds of things can be done? And are there some things that we might want to be careful with?
So I think the careful thing first, right? Because it's very easy to jump to always the kind of the sexy stuff first, right? Then I just think in terms of that there is still an element of control and rigor that I think everyone needs in decision sort of generation. I don't think any sort of regulator or any sort of authority is going to be convinced on, hey, because ChatGPT said it, then it's right. And I just think that there will have to be some sort of improvement in validation, scalability, around how do you check around the source of information, which is generating the answer. Because over time, they could be representing financial decisions which are worth billions of dollars, could be or medical decisions which essentially are getting determined on that type of information set. So I think there's going to be a lot of probing as well as a lot of demand around the validation side of generative AI. So I think that's still a long way to go before it becomes fully mainstream. But on the opportunity side, like the volume of basically assimilating so many different sorts of information sources in order to provide new ways to look at essentially product concepts, even looking at, I would say, ways to how to tackle potentially diseases, I think is going to be game changing for society, right? Because I think there's so much medical information, for example, that you just can't assimilate it all. You can't compare and ingest it all. And using hopefully the power of ChatGPT in the future, maybe with some spreadsheets on the side, I think there could be some incredible sort of uncovery of ways of how we can actually improve resistance to some diseases which exist out there. So I'm hoping it's going to be used for things like that, which is kind of fast tracks sort of human intelligence that way, as well as obviously just automating a lot of mundane tasks which exist across life, right? And if it can do that, then it makes our lives a lot easier just as a society.
Now, obviously, no-code, low-code platforms can definitely benefit from the generative AI kind of generation of things. What's coherent thinking here? Is it possible to make things easier and to be able to manage these applications using generative AI technologies like ChatGPT?
So I think like we see ourselves as no-code, DevOps, automation, as well as data as a capability in one platform. So therefore, if you look at all those elements, generative AI should essentially improve all components of it, that, right? So reality should help us drive further automation improvements and performance improvements. It should enable us to ingest and do more with the data that we have and provide insights to our customers. I think it will produce ways that we do process improvement on the whole DevOps cycle, finding that way to tune. And then essentially, I think it will explore new ways of how you can create kind of codified objects and codified capability to further enhance the products and services that you provide. So I think it's going to be game changing for us. And clearly we've been starting to assign team members over the past 6-9 months about how we take advantage of some of these capabilities. And it's been frightening to me to see like the progress our team's made over the course of that period, but also what you're seeing elsewhere. So I think we've got to leverage it in order to stay ahead of competition, as well as obviously continue to maximize where we could be as a business.
Now, you did mention competition, so I'm going to say that you did open the door to that one. I'm going to ask you just one quick question about that. Now, obviously, there's some competitors out there. There's I've seen Spreadsheet, Web, there's Mendix. Obviously, there's also, if you combine Power Apps using Excel as a data source, there's also those kind of low-code solutions. What's Coherent here? Like, what advantages does Coherent have on top of those?
Yeah, a good question. I think, almost think of us like Intel Inside for spreadsheets, right? We're effectively this kind of secret processing capability, which can power no-code apps, power legacy platforms, generate natively ways of how you to kind of create new sort of solutions and concepts. So I think our applicability is like Excel, like almost ubiquitous, right? In terms of where Excel is, we can play a kind of capability to improve and power things. And I think because of the fact it can be native or it can be plugged in to different solutions, that's what provides that sort of unique differentiator. Like you can get going within the space of 2 hours and you can have a result within 5 minutes. Very few software solutions are able that capability, and that ROI is incredible. And that's what most of our clients obviously have loved so far.
So the last thing I want to ask, I'm sure Schubert has some more questions here, is around the fact that, you know, obviously we talked a little bit about where the data is going. And I'm just curious, in fact, people in the chat room are asking about this because people will continue to use spreadsheets and they will continue to use, and, you know, they'll continue to export data into spreadsheets. They'll continue to do analytics in there. How does this kind of work in tandem with this new app that you've created or this new environment that you've created that you're hosting, whether it's an on-prem or it's a hybrid? How do we keep that in sync?
Yeah. So think of the spreadsheets, the source code. So this one of the unique aspects here is that we don't think people are ever getting off spreadsheets. I'm sure you wouldn't be working on Excel if you thought they were as well.
Job security, but, yeah.
But the reality is, it's got one of the largest captive user bases in the world. You guys are clearly creating new functionality and capability, which is making it better and better. So use that as a source code, and therefore, what we've inserted is much more robust version controlling, so that any time that source gets changed, then the data transition also changes through into the source systems moving forward. And I think that's part of the magic of obviously the capability, where the business user or whoever the user is, could be a technical user, continues to do what they're doing, but the source of transition of the any logic change, formula change, calculation, data change flows through as well as part of that version update. So therefore, the amount of time you're saving through obviously software updates internally, or even data sort of ingestion into our platforms, that's why we're able to do native integrations into things like Snowflake, etc., because that sort of flow through is automatic and seamless. And again, like, we've always been thinking about the end user, but also how do you make sure that you don't have to then go and recompile elsewhere to make it all kind of sync. Otherwise, you're creating pain for your customers. So again, that's been something which we thought about from the start. It's been something which, why a product took a number of years to build, because we realized it had to be like that in order to succeed.
Well, let me take a stab at, I think, our last question before we run out of time, is when someone wants to use Coherent to help deal with this ball of yarn that is their spreadsheet environment, is there some sort of homework that they should do before they give you a call? And the second half is, do you folks have a global services component to Coherent to help people unwind that ball of yarn?
So ball of yarn or web of complexity, we hear different terms. There's some more vulgar terms that some executives may use in firms, but we'll go with the ball of yarn. So ultimately, when you're devising a SaaS product, you've got to be thinking about how do you make it intuitive and easy for your user or customer to be able to embed. So we essentially, in simple ways, are asking the user to continue to use the spreadsheets, which they're using today. All they're having to do is essentially tag inputs and outputs in their model. And once they do that through a naming range convention that we provide, the rest is magic, right? That's all the user has to do. And then once it gets uploaded, then obviously there's certain actions around testing and things along those lines, which users do. But that simple task of automating the tagging or doing the tagging of your spreadsheet is step one. And then that's why some clients are basically trained and deployed within the space of 4 hours, because that's how effective it can be to kind of get going in the platform. So that's always been part of our USP about that simplicity to kind of train up people. The services side is a very good question. When I started the business, this is like essentially a completely new concept if you think about the codification of spreadsheets in an enterprise grade scale. So we had to offer some services as a team to begin with to help see this through in some of our initial clients. But now that we don't have essentially a services arm, we leverage some of the largest consultants or boutique consultancies who will work with our clients to essentially install and deploy the platform as wide and vast as they want to, right? So it tends not to be the installation. It tends to be when they're trying to connect all these models or logic through to lots of different types of systems. That's where they'll get some of those partners involved. So we kind of pride ourselves now in being a very sort of SaaS focused company with services done by partners.
Well, folks, time flies when you're having fun. Lots of great information here. John, thank you so much for being here. We're running obviously low on time, but before we close out, I do want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where they can find more about Coherent, how they can get started, how they can maybe, is there a try for before you buy kind of scenario?
Yeah, so on our website, which is www.coherent.global, it's essentially there's a lot of information around the product, but also there is a way to kind of understand from a light version of the product to start to get a look and feel of how the product works on basically a trial basis. And then we've always love to get obviously different kind of feedback from our customers or even trialers around how we can improve the product. So in our GitHub and society and community as well, a number of ways of how to get access to us.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcaster to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host. I want to start with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, amazing seeing you as always. Can you tell the folks at home where you're going to be in the coming weeks or where can people find your work?
I am going to be hiding. I've got a bunch of different things I got to get done. Not the least of which I discovered a task or a duty, shall we say, of being on a board of directors for a charity. And that's, I actually have to quantify my donations in kind and my hours. I thought I was done with timesheets. But
never done with spreadsheets.
Yeah, well, apparently there is quite a few grants that do play games with donation matching, and apparently their favorite target is the board of directors. So learning new things about being a board of director, and gee, it's a lot of work.
That it is. Any good way for people to get in touch with you if they have show ideas?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. My Twitter, which I still use, I'm not that big on Mastodon quite yet. But my Twitter is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And I tend to kind of lean towards the oceanographic world on that. I also posted some pictures of the kebabs I made for dinner the other night. Realistically, yes, kebabs. That's actually a grill that can do charcoal or wood, which is kind of cool. Anyway, I would love to hear show ideas. We book pretty far in advance, but we do love to hear your show ideas. You can also send me email. I am Chebert, spelled Cheebert at twit.tv. And you're also welcome to throw email at twit@twit.tv, which will hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear your ideas. We don't mind, you know, constructive criticism. And just feel like you can share with us and stay safe.
Thank you, Jibber. It's always great having you here. Well, folks, we also thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes. Of course, the show notes, the co-host information, and the guest information. Of course, more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version or the video version of your choice and listen on any one of your devices, any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and support the show. Plus, you may have also heard another way to support the show of all of our shows is Club Twit. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. There's a lot of great things about Club Twit. In fact, one of them is exclusive access to this amazing members-only Discord server. Now, you can chat with hosts, producers. There's a lot of separate discussion channels in there. Oh, my gosh. There's endless amounts. There's cooking in there. It's amazing. Plus, they also have some special events as well. So definitely join Club Twit. Be part of that movement. Go to twit.tv/club. Twit. Now, Club Twit also offers corporate group plans as well. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcast. The plans start with just 5 members at a discounted rate of just $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And really, this is a great way for your IT department, your developers, your tech teams, your SREs, anyone to really stay up to date and access to all of our podcasts. And just like that regular membership, they can join the Twit Discord server and get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So join Club Twit, twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers, whoever, with the gift of Twit, because we have a lot of fun on this show. We talk about some interesting tech topics, and I guarantee they will find them fun and interesting as well. So definitely ask them to subscribe and join the show. Now, after you've subscribed and you're available, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, that's right, we do this show live right now. Go to live.twit.tv. We have all of our streams there. Choose each one of them. You could see, come see how the pizza's made, all the behind the scenes, all the banter before and after the show, lots of fun stuff. So definitely join and watch the show live, because it's a lot more fun like that too as well. And of course, you know, we also have our infamous IRC channels as well at irc.twit.tv. It takes you into the Twit Live channel, and they have some amazing characters in there right now. In fact, they're giving us some amazing show titles that I can't help but almost laughing during my segment here. But I do want to say thank you guys for all your support. And of course, you want to join that chat room if you can. So irc.twit.tv. Now, definitely hit me up, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post every day. Of course, I also post on Mastodon at louMM@twit.social. Whether it's Twitter or Mastodon, direct message me, send me messages on Twitter directly, whatever you want, because I am always open to conversations, show ideas, topics, things like that, how-to type things. I'm up for that as well. If you want to know what I do during my normal work week as well, please check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post all the latest and greatest ways for you to make Office more productive for you. And in fact, if you have Microsoft 365 and you have Excel open right now, go to that Automate tab, because that is where I live. That's the amazing new Office scripts and Excel scripts that you can basically record, generate JavaScript, TypeScript, and you can run them in Power Automate. You can build all different types of integrations with that. So definitely check that out and see how you can really make it more productive for you. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. And really, we really couldn't do the show without them. So thank you to Leo and Lisa for all their support over the years. And of course, thank you to all the engineers at Twit and the staff, because again, they make it a reality for us to do this show. And of course, thank you to Mr. Brian Chi, right, one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He's just talking about it. He's doing all the bookings and trying to get everything in line and doing all the plannings for the show. So, Gbert, thank you for all your support. Of course, before we sign out, I want to thank our editor for today, Mr. Anthony. Anthony, you make us look good after the fact. You take all my mistakes out. So thank you, sir. And of course, our technical director for today, our TD, the talented Mr. Ann Pruitt, which also does an amazing show called Hands On Photography, which I watch religiously each and every week. And I need to know what's going on this week in that show.
Well, thank you, Mr. Liu. I appreciate the support. This week, I had the chance to sit down with a friend of mine, Ms. Susie Botello, as we talked about the Mobile Film Festival that's coming up this weekend. And then my camera went weird during the broadcast, so Mr. Victor had fun with the edit. And yeah, I'm just going to leave it at that. So go watch it, twit.tv/HOP. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ant. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. You already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.